Welcome to S&C's podcast series, S&C Critical Insights. I'm Krishna Varagavan, a partner in S&C's M&A practice. With me today is Brad King, an associate in our M&A practice as well. One of the major developments on Wall Street over the last 2 weeks was the stalling of WeWork's much-anticipated IPO. Maybe even more significant was the decision by WeWork CEO and co-founder Adam Neumann to step down amid investor pressure. As has been widely reported, the investor community grew concerned with WeWork's governance structure. In particular, WeWork's IPO filings disclosed Mr. Neumann's plan to hold a class of supervoting stock. The supervoting stock would have allowed Mr. Neumann to retain voting control of the public company. These concerns were compounded by a recent Wall Street Journal article that created misgivings about Mr. Neumann's behavior as CEO. In connection with Mr. Neumann stepping down, reports also indicate that Mr. Neumann's super voting shares will be diluted from 20 votes per share to 3 votes per share. In short, Mr. Neumann will no longer have majority voting control of WeWork. The scrutiny WeWork's super voting shares attracted is the most recent chapter in an ongoing debate around so-called dual-class stock structures. This debate, which touches on issues ranging from capital markets to corporate governance to M&A, is what we'll be discussing today. First, we'll explain how dual-class structures, like the one at WeWork, operate in practice. Next, we'll cover the current debate on dual-class structures. And lastly, we'll discuss topics of interest for dual-class companies, such as shareholder activism, reclassification transactions, and M&A. Dual-class structures have been a hot topic this year. They remain a major point of interest for the tech sector in particular, as well as for quasi-tech companies like WeWork. Technology giants like Google and Facebook famously IPO'd with dual-class structures, and Lyft, Zoom, and Pinterest all did the same this year. But dual-class structures are not new or unique to tech. Many household names like CBS, Ford Motor, and Nike have had these structures for decades. So what are dual-class structures? Dual-class structures come in many shapes and sizes. Most public companies have only one class of stock with one vote per share. A dual-class company, by contrast, has two classes of stock with different voting rights. One class of stock, the high-voting stock, grants holders voting powers that are disproportionate to their equity ownership. These super-voting powers can take many forms, including multiple votes per share or the right to designate a majority of the board of directors. High-vote shares are typically held by insiders, such as a company's founder. The public investors will hold the low-vote stock with one or even no votes per share. Investors, founders, regulators, attorneys, and academics have had a lot to say about these dual-class structures. Let's discuss the debate next. One frequent criticism is that dual-class structures impede board oversight. A basic tenet of corporate governance is that shareholders rely on faithful directors to hold management accountable. And when shareholders are dissatisfied with directors, they can elect replacements. But when corporate insiders both manage the company and through their high-vote shares elect a majority of the board, this accountability framework can break down, and this is to the detriment of shareholders. A second criticism points out the practical reality that many dual-class companies are takeover-proof. Put another way, when high-vote shares confer negative control, holders of high-vote shares are immune from the discipline of the market for corporate control. A prominent argument in favor of dual-class structures is the visionary founder argument. On this view, everyone benefits when founders of unique talent retain voting control. The firm needs to be protected from investors who don't recognize the founder's ability to generate returns. Without these safeguards, investors could, at the critical moment, overrule the founder or even oust them. It's often said the shadow of Steve Jobs looms large in Silicon Valley. One critique of the visionary founder argument has been made recently by Lucian Bebchuk and Kobe Castile of Harvard Law School. They acknowledge the argument may hold at the time of the company's initial public offering. But in their view, the ever-changing business environment and inevitable effects of time counsel that dual-class structures should not be set in stone. In addition to WeWork, Uber Technologies provides another interesting case in point. Earlier this year, in connection with a significant investment by SoftBank, Uber overhauled its corporate governance. This overhaul included eliminating the super voting rights held by certain stockholders, most notably co-founder Travis Kalanick. Mr. Kalanick had resigned as Uber CEO the prior year following some high-profile scandals and controversies. Uber is an interesting example for Bebchuk and Castile's argument that dual-class structures should lapse after a fixed period unless ratified by the low-vote stockholders. Defenders of dual-class structures also make a private ordering argument. They point out that before buying low-vote stock, an investor should have read extensive SEC disclosures. Facebook, for example, made this point in its 2019 proxy in response to a shareholder proposal to eliminate its dual-class structure. Quote, "The dual-class capital structure was implemented well before our initial public offering, and all of our investors who purchased shares of our Class A common stock in our initial public offering and after were aware of our capital structure." Close quote. On this view, these are rights the investor is simply not paying for. Much empirical research has been conducted on whether dual-class structures are value-creating or value-destroying. Unfortunately, as Joe Fish and Stephen Davidoff Solomon note in a recent article, quote, "Empirical studies have failed to provide conclusive evidence as to the effect of dual-class structures." Close quote. Their article, however, does provide an excellent survey of recent empirical work if that's of further interest. With this background, let's turn to some topics of interest for dual-class companies, starting with shareholder activism.
Thanks, Rishan. A common misconception is that dual-class companies are somehow immune to shareholder activism. However, this is not the case. Activism is alive and well at companies with dual-class stock structures and presents special complexities. Activists have taken aim at the way high-vote shareholders are managing dual-class companies or painted a dual-class structure as an impediment to unlocking shareholder value. By and large, these arguments echo the current debate on dual-class structures, which Krishna outlined earlier. A dual-class company's level of vulnerability to shareholder activism will vary case by case. If some directors are elected by the holders of low-vote stock, for example, then the traditional short-slate proxy contest remains viable to the activist. But where there is no path to the boardroom, activists can instead rely on public pressure, like naming and shaming, to further their ends. Whether it's because of activist pressure or commercial practicalities, dual-class companies sometimes consider eliminating their dual-class structures midstream. There are many ways that this can be accomplished, but the most common path is the share reclassification transaction. So let's discuss that. A reclassification is accomplished by adopting a charter amendment that unifies the high vote and the low vote shares. As a simple example, the amendment could reclassify each high vote share into one low vote share. A key challenge in any reclassification transaction is assessing the relative values of the high vote and the low vote shares. Here, investment bankers play an important role in identifying a fair financial premium to be paid to the insiders for ceding their high voting rights. From a legal standpoint, a reclassification transaction involving a controlling shareholder receiving a non-ratable benefit would ordinarily trigger heightened legal scrutiny. In Delaware, however, such a transaction should be reviewed using the more deferential business judgment rule if the two protections laid out in the landmark MFW decision are observed. Specifically, the reclassification must be conditioned ab initio upon the approval of both an independent, adequately empowered special committee that fulfills its duty of care and the uncoerced, informed vote of a majority of the minority stockholders. If these safeguards are met, then the reclassification is viewed as an arm's length bargain and will be reviewed under the business judgment rule. A reclassification involving a controlling shareholder may also be considered a going private transaction under the Securities and Exchange Act. To protect unaffiliated stockholders, SEC Rule 13(e)(3) requires specific and detailed public disclosures about these going private transactions. The structure and effects of any reclassification transaction should therefore be analyzed at the outset to determine whether SEC Rule 13(e)(3) applies.
Our last topic for today is the legal consideration for M&A involving dual-class companies. Under Delaware law, the sale of a dual-class company with a controlling stockholder will be subject to entire fairness review if it is a conflicted transaction. This would occur, for example, if the controller receives a greater or different consideration for its high-vote shares than do the holders of low-vote shares. Such a transaction would, however, be subject to the business judgment review if the two protections laid out in MFW are implemented. Even if the transaction is subject to entire fairness review, A controlling shareholder is, with limited exception, entitled under Delaware law to negotiate a fair control premium for itself. It would, however, be inappropriate for the controller to receive a special premium if the dual class company has a so-called fair price provision in its charter. These provisions require all shares to be purchased for the same price in a takeover. In such circumstances, Delaware courts have concluded that the holders of the supermajority shares, supervoting shares, have already bargained away the right to a control premium. In sum, careful transaction planning is required when evaluating the purchase or sale of a dual class company. Thank you for listening to S&C Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.sulcrom.com. For more news and M&A, check out the S&C Deal Portal, your must-read briefing on what matters today in M&A.